This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for September 22nd, 2018. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger Michaels. I'm glad you're here. Hopefully you are too, or you're about to be. Hi. So today I'm talking to Josie Breckner. She also goes by the name Visager. You may know her under that name. She makes a lot of great music under it, including but not limited to her work for games. She did the soundtrack for Blossom Tales, which you have a better than even chance of having tried if you were an early Switch adopter. It's a good game. And most recently, she's working on new stuff now, but most prominently perhaps within this interview, she did the Powered by Blood soundtrack for Extreme Meat Punks Forever. Which is really good. It's a really good game. Her work for it is kind of extraordinary. The whole package feels really urgent and necessary right now. Her music is a huge part of that. And so we talk about why and a whole bunch of other stuff. It's a rather delightful conversation in a somewhat echoey room. Hopefully the former will outweigh the latter for you. Enjoy.
Okay, cool. So, Josie Breckner, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Drew.
Yeah, totally. Also known as Visager, right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
So, the reason we're talking is not all I want to talk about, but we're here to talk about your work for Extreme Meat Punks Forever.
Yes.
So, I'll ask the boring question to get started. How would you describe the game for anybody who's not heard of it?
Well, a couple weekends ago, I was just spending 48 hours showing it off at Play NYC here in New York, and the easiest, most straightforward pitch that I settled on was, it's a game where you use mech suits made out of meat to punch neo-Nazis off a cliff. But it's also like a road trip game.
Yeah.
And it's also a queer game. So it's just all of those things smooshed together.
For sure. Yeah, and it's like, well, it is sort of divided into two halves in a sense. The combat feels different from the sort of the road trip, the story elements. Mm-hmm. And like the meat mechs are unwieldy in about the way that a meat mech should be unwieldy. Like it feels, I don't know, you feel a little separated from yourself when you're doing it in a way that seems appropriate.
Yeah, or maybe you feel closer to yourself.
It's kind of both. That's a good point. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're augmented. So how did you get involved with the game? Did Heather, the developer, start it and then like reach out to you? Were you involved from the beginning?
I don't know when the official beginning was. The whole production process, from Heather's perspective, was about 9 months.
Okay.
So the game came out this past July. So, you know, the fall previous. Heather was joking online that the time it took to gestate Meat Punks was basically making one human child.
Okay. and again, weirdly appropriate with the body.
Yeah, there's some weird stuff. Disturbing stuff going on.
Yeah, yeah.
She's so great. And so I met Heather through Twitter. I had played Secret Spaces and Gender Wrecked, two games that she had worked on, and had really special experiences with them for different reasons. And so I cold emailed her like last summer and was like, hey, Heather, like, my name is, I was going by my dead name then, mm-hmm. and I would love to work with you sometime. Your stuff is really awesome. And she graciously was like, sure, like maybe down the line we can do something. And so, I mean, I assume that like a lot of people were reaching out to her and didn't expect to hear much of it. But then, yeah, early last January, she just hit me up and was like, hey, I'm working on Meat Punks. You want to talk about it?
Neat.
So, yeah, it's one of those weird times where things kind of just fell into place.
Yeah.
Also, like, I came out in between the first email to her and, like, we started to be a little chummier on Twitter, so... Mm-hmm. Definitely the trans connection is always a really powerful one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, as is appropriate for a game about bodies and being closer to yourself and separated from yourself, like, the game is very much, not completely about, but largely about queerness and gender not being clear or not, like, finding identity, like, all that kind of stuff. So it makes sense that, you know, bonding over that would make the game that much stronger, like, thematically.
Yeah. I mean, body horror is a theme that I think Heather could talk on a little more eloquently than I can, but
it's fair.
Something very near and dear to the trans experience in that we're A, constantly changing our bodies and B, constantly experimenting with things because there's not a great government-funded science to tell us what is healthy, what is safe. And so, yeah, we are kind of pilgrims on this weird trans body hacking journey.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I don't by any means want this to become like, please explain trans stuff to a clueless, well-meaning cis dude. But it's in the game, right? And like to a certain degree, it's like that David Lynch thing of like you make a movie and people want you to talk about it, but the movie is the talking. Like I know the game is the talking. And it's pretty eloquent in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's cool. That's why I wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's super cool. It's incredibly cool. I mean, and the game is like, and this is part of the of Heather's like meat punk manifesto, but the game is aggressively, it's unabashed. Aggressive is the wrong word. I mean, it is aggressive, but it's about that stuff. It's just like, it's totally unashamed and out there with all that stuff in a way that a lot of more mainstream games, you know, movies, media in general play coy about that kind of stuff. They need to mask it with an allegory or something. Like this stuff just is about a cast of you know, queer and trans people who are on a road trip together and getting closer and all that stuff. It's not masked in any way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the unofficial Meat Punk's subtitle is Subtlety is for Fuckers.
Yeah. Yes. Which is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's inspirational, really.
For sure. I mean, subtlety is overrated, I think, in general. For a couple of reasons. I mean, it makes it easy to miss, right? You always have that problem. When, this is, comes up with satire, obviously, a lot, mm-hmm. where you can be mistaken for the thing you're critiquing. But I think in general, I think a lot about whether people actually read the allegories that are intended or there or whatever when they're playing something. Like, I feel like, it's not that people are stupid, it's just like there is value in owning what you say and saying what you mean in a way that a lot of media doesn't. I think they're like, we were briefly talking about Wolfenstein before we got started, mm-hmm. or like the trailer for the new Doom or something like that. There's a lot of games that are big budget, you know, AAA is a silly term, but like big old games that gesture at important topics, but like refuse to own what they're saying about them.
Right.
So to me, it's a breath of fresh air to play something that just like is very clear about what it's saying and explore, because it lets you go deeper. You don't have to skim the surface.
Right. I mean, it goes back to like just the fact that AAA games are primarily vehicles to make money in the same way that summer blockbusters are, and that producers just won't take political risks and worry about alienating a base and often side with the status quo, and the status quo is wrapped up with some really terrible stuff, especially right now. So that's why you see a lot of that. I think also, like regarding subtlety itself, I think in a post-2016 world, like we just don't have time or energy for subtlety. I think we should block people on Twitter who are assholes and not give them a second chance if they're talking to us in bad faith. And we should make art that reflects our anger and frustration with the situation right now.
Yeah. There's a ton to unpack there. So one thing is, I think it's actually really important to refuse to do the Taylor Swift thing of like, well, white nationalists buy records too, so I maybe shouldn't say anything, right? And even that is a meaning I'm having to ascribe to her silence. For anybody listening who doesn't know what the hell I'm talking about, Taylor Swift has a lot of fans who are white nationalist Nazis, white supremacists of various kinds, because she's kind of their blonde goddess figure. And largely that's projected onto her. It's not something she's necessarily cultivated, but it's also something she seems to go out of her way to not undo, to not deny, right?
Right.
So in that silence, they hear affirmation, and I think everyone else hears at least indifference, maybe cynicism, because again, Nazis buy records too. I think there's a lot of power in refusing to do that. If you're making art, or if you run a space or something like that, to actively say you're not welcome here if you're a bigot, I think is like one of the most powerful and important things that somebody can do to a certain degree.
Yeah, I mean, also like with Taylor Swift, and I don't know that much about like her specific situation, but you know, there's so much institutional pressure mm-hmm. against her taking more direct stance. And again, that's
totally,
producers
totally.
Being involved and all the other people who are riding on her tailcoats.
Coattails,
yeah.
No, that's a really good point. I don't mean to ascribe it completely to an individual, especially for someone like that. Where,
but like, but yeah, it's her face, yeah. It's her name. And so, yeah, you do have a responsibility to stand up for yourselves in that way. I was kind of having like a moral quandary on the subway this morning.
It's a good place for one.
Yeah, there's a lot of reflection and a self-doubt that goes on the subway, I think,
sure.
In general. But yeah, I'm talking right now about partnering to teach an audio class with this organization, and like they've done some work with Verizon, and Verizon is a corporation that I despise. And so I don't know whether it's more radical to just be like, I don't want to work with you, or if it's more radical to get paid and build my career and do more stuff. And as I'm saying that out loud, the latter option sounds lamer and lamer, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's no purity, right? Like, people say there's no ethical way to act in capitalism, or maybe specifically late capitalism. I don't know about that, but there's certainly no clear way. There's no unambiguously good thing to do most of the time.
Right.
I mean, like, we're recording this and we're trying to have a good faith conversation about how to act ethically, but at the same time, like, I'm using an Apple laptop. You know what I mean? Like, there's no way to be completely pure and still participate in the methods of distribution and all that stuff that make it possible to get your message out there in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and also everyone has to eat, which is something that I feel like gets left out of the conversation kind of a lot. Uh-huh. I think about this a lot, that like the starving artist mythos was created by people who were definitely not starving. Puccini was not starving when he wrote La Boheme, you know? So it's like, it is in a certain way, whether intentional or unintentional, a way of keeping the people with the most radical ideas out of power. So maybe that's a point in the favor of use the money that was created unethically to make good things. But yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah. It's very complicated.
Yeah. Because if you're looking for untainted money, I'm not sure it exists, you know?
Right.
It's maybe five steps removed instead of one step, but it's, yeah, how much of a difference is that ultimately? I don't know. It's hard. It's really challenging. I don't mean that as a snarky rhetorical question. I mean, literally, it's hard.
Yeah, I don't. I'm still figuring a lot of stuff out myself.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So, okay. So as far as subtlety itself,
mm-hmm.
The Meat Punk Manifesto, one of the things is subtlety is for fuckers. Mm-hmm. Another thing, let's actually stick with that for a second. How did you approach... I mean, I don't know when the manifesto was written, if the game was started and then the manifesto was written.
No, there was a manifesto jam back, like, yeah, sometime before...
Okay.
Like, the game came out of the manifesto, which was written for this jam, as far as I know.
The practice, like, came out of the theory kind of thing.
I believe so, yes.
So would you say that the music you've written for the game is meat punk? In that sense?
I mean, I hope so.
Yeah, okay. Well, I didn't know if that was your intent, right? I didn't want to ascribe that to you. So in what way do you feel that it's meat punk? Like, how did you approach making it so,
well,
I guess?
If you're quizzing me on the manifesto, I don't remember.
No, not a bit. In fact, I'll bring it up. My goal was not to put you on the spot.
The specific tenets.
Yeah. So the thing that I was thinking about the most was the subtlety is for fuckers.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, art is political. Don't let your art be co-opted by fascists.
Yeah.
Meat punk games are about survival. And
yeah, I mean, we're going down the list right here. Bodies are weird and gross, but also cool. Like, we've hit a lot of these already. Make art, make rent, help others do the same. Like, yeah. I think... I wasn't really going back to the manifesto when I was working on Meat Punks as much as...
Yeah.
This stuff was coming up in conversations with Heather.
For sure.
The kinds of things that we were using as references for the music. Just sort of a shared vision about the world in general in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So this stuff just comes up.
That's fair. Yeah. No, I guess the reason I think it's especially interesting in the context of music, stupid chair, is that...
Should we swap it out?
No, that's okay. I think it's fine. Okay. I'll just try to squirm less. I get excited is all. No, I was just going to say, music is a little bit less rhetorical, at least usually, right, than procedural rhetoric in games, than straight-up writing. I think it's... potentially harder, maybe you disagree, you know a hell of a lot more about it than I do, right? But I think it's harder to make like an explicit, non-subtle political argument with just music than with other forms, you know, so...
Yes. I mean, in that it's like abstract and
right.
We can't necessarily ascribe direct literal meaning to music, but I would like to think that like the music for Meat Punks is trans in a lot of ways. Like we were... taking influence from a bunch of different trans artists working in different genres. And I think there is like something to be said in the way that you curate the kind of music you make for a game. And so part of like the meat punk aesthetic, which is really like a non-aesthetic,
mm-hmm.
Is basically just mashing things together and just doing what works.
Mm-hmm.
And as the game is that, with its mix of like ASCII art and like more high def, like awesome illustrations by Amy, who did a lot of the character art, and
stuff that looks hand drawn and stuff that looks assembled, and...
right? Stuff that's glitchy, mm-hmm. stuff that's like quote unquote like bad. We had a lot of people complaining on like Rock Paper Shotgun about like not liking the visuals, and
specifically during the fights or in general.
I think just in general, like I mean, we can get into this, but you know, there's an association between like pristine visuals and like game quality
for sure.
And like this is something that Robert Yang, for example, likes to exploit by making like really sexual political games with mm-hmm. like the AAA very polished aesthetic in 3D.
He puts all of his time into like one really, really good character model so that it looks AAA, but he's doing stuff that you would not see in right. games that generally do that kind of thing.
Yeah, like having dudes suck off other dudes' guns in a bathroom.
Yeah. Which didn't even, he made them guns because he couldn't get, he knew penises would get banned immediately, but guns are fine.
Right.
It yeah. also ended up being super resonant with the game he was making, but yeah.
Yeah.
That. Yes.
So the music is very much related in that sense where mm-hmm. we're just mashing like seven different genres together and
totally.
Hopefully making something new out of that, but also yeah. like rejecting this idea that like things have to sound polished or things have to fit together.
I like that each character has their own battle theme and it's cohesive, but it also expresses each of their own personalities. Like, I feel like I don't know how to say this, besides a lesser composer, would have made each one like a true genre goof. Like Sam would have actually been like a bluegrass tune or something. Mm-hmm. But instead it's Meat Punk with a banjo. You know what I mean? Like it expresses him and like the kind of more rural place he comes from or something like that. But it's not kitschy in any way, right? Like it's unafraid.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So the character fight themes were a very, very late addition. When Heather pitched, when we sat down, we met at GDC in person mm-hmm. for the first time. And so we had tacos together and we talked through what kind of music might the game want in terms of like, here's some music for when they're getting in the mix and here's mm-hmm. some conversation music. And eventually she sent me an email with a list of the specific like descriptions of each song that she was envisioning with references. And so a lot of the stylistic decisions were made by Heather because I think she's just has like a really clear vision of what she wants and she's an awesome director. But we kind of ran out of time to necessarily develop out all the character themes. And we talked about maybe saving that for a season two of Meat Punks. But she found some extra money in the budget and I was eager enough to be like, I think we can do this in 2 weeks. Mm. So I wrote Sam's fight theme in the game, which is like this kind of like folk punk bluegrass.
Mm-hmm. Kind of Meat Puppets-y slightly.
Odeph,
yeah.
Situation, like that was going to be like the fight theme. So that was like the most emblematic of like what we thought Meat Punks was. And Sam is the first character you start as. So there's like this sort of like core tie to the story of the game. But so we built out the other themes using that structure from the same song. So all the songs can like exist in parallel and swap between each other. Mm-hmm. And so in doing that sort of dynamic treatment of these four character fight themes, it was helpful to blend the sounds a little bit. So you have Cass's music and like their song is primarily like this glitch electronic. I was listening to a lot of Rook's mm-hmm. Feather.
You actually turned me on to Rook.
And yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's really incredible. And yeah. It's lush and it's glitchy and it's all that stuff. Yeah.
It's really cool. Yeah. But you know, that has like some of this like orchestral vibe or some of like the drums from like other songs. So
right.
things get to blend a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Liara,
Liana.
Liana, excuse me. Oh my mm-hmm. God. I'm Liara. I'm thinking Mass Effect. That's cool. Her theme is more of like a straight ahead rock thing, like bass driven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they all have a similarly propulsive vibe and the fact that they can swap is incredibly exciting.
Yeah. I got to actually subcontract my friend M to play bass on Liana's fight mm-hmm. theme. The song is called Crash Queen and they just really knocked it out of the park. It's a lot of people's favorite song.
It's neat. It's really good.
It's really growly and good.
That's also, hers is my favorite mech to be in general. So, you know, just that's the speed and the momentum like lends itself really well to when you have to fight multiple, especially the big meat mechs. Uh-huh. So yeah, I've heard that tune a lot and enjoyed it tremendously.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. So we haven't said this, but the game is being released episodically. Mm-hmm. 6 episodes in season 1. Is that the deal? There's 5 out right now.
Yeah.
And then you're already planning on season 2 or?
Both Heather and I are doing academic stuff right now.
Fair enough.
So I think it's on the shelf, but we haven't talked concretely about
cool.
it.
Cool. Yeah. So, but with the exception of the fight theme, the music is reused in really smart ways, right? Like there's kind of one main theme for when you're having conversations. There's themes for when shit gets real. Mm-hmm. There's themes for each person fighting. Mm-hmm. Was the original plan for you to write everything up front and then have it get used throughout the season? And then, as you said, more budget happened, you added more?
Sort of. We talked a lot about like the schedule, and the schedule was really flexible. And
sure.
one of the things that Heather was really clear on was that she didn't want to like have any crunch involved
for sure.
in the production process. So she was constantly like, hey, like let me know if you need more time. Like, we have the flexibility to push things back. And also with like the delayed, you know, episodic release schedule, there was always the opportunity to add things in. Mm-hmm. And technically, like, Brad's fight theme was added in like before the second episode. So like that had extra time built into it. But most of the work was done before things started releasing because, I had a busy summer. And so I was like, okay, I can just do it all now. Yeah, I have some free time.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is actually, not to quiz you, just bring it up. This was, and I don't mean to keep coming back to Manifesto. It's just kind of like, that was what convinced me to play the game originally. You know?
Okay.
Someone linked me to that, and I was like, I'm a chump for games with Manifesto. So that's like why I started playing Tale of Tales games, you know, back in the day. But the idea of like, you know, make art, make rent, help others do the same. Like the fact that you're actively avoiding crunch, the fact that, you know, it was explicitly not, hey, could you eke out a couple more tunes, but hey, I have more budget, let's make more music. That seems to me as radical in a certain way as anything in terms of how you're making games.
Yeah. That's like a very like classic like punk ethos. If the ethos is the right word, I always get them confused. Where like Laura Jane Grace in Against Me shows would, you just always split everything just down the middle. And so in games as much as possible, like obviously in this case, Heather's like funny in the game and like it doesn't make sense to split things down the middle because it's really not like egalitarian. That idea still lingers in terms of just no reason to dick people over.
Right.
It's just, why would you want to do that?
Right.
Who are the people that choose to do that? And how can you not work with them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Everything's going to be better for everyone if we can go out of our way to do nice things for other people. And that includes finding work situations that are accommodating to people's different needs and not just greedily scrounging for money all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because so much of that is not about how you get it made. It's not even about how to make money. It's about how to maximize the amount of money you make. Not necessarily maximize the quality of the work or the amount of work even you're going to get out of someone.
Yeah.
The churn and burn thing is as common in games as it is in any other kind of tech or media, where you hire someone super young and talented and who potentially doesn't know better, and you get as much crazy crunch out of them as you can, and then you discard them and they either go on to the next thing that's identical or they move on with their lives and stop doing the thing that they thought they wanted to do. It sucks. It really sucks.
Yeah. And it was a really interesting experience for me. So this was probably the second biggest project I've worked on in my games history. The first one being Blossom Tales, The Sleeping King, which
Your tunes for that are great, by the way. And totally different from this.
Thank you.
Much more like old school chiptune-y kind of thing. But thank you.
And so it was really interesting comparing just those like work experiences. Like the company that was publishing Blossom Tales is like a German company, so there's like a bit of a language barrier. They would like write me emails and be like, "Hi Josie, I hope you are fine." And I'm like, "What did I do?" And when I met them in person, they were like, "Wait, we thought fine is better than good." And I'm like, "No, it's a lot worse." I learned a lot on that job. And in between Heather's initial email to me, pitching me Punks, and when we met up to talk about and hammer out like a contract, I told her like, "Hey, I super undercharged myself when I sent you my rates before. Like, this is what I should be making at this stage." And so she was really good about not in that situation being like, "No, you said this.
Yeah.
We're going to stick to this rate or I'll find someone else." Like that would be like the terrible kind of person thing to do. She was like, "Okay, like how can we sort of make this work?" And so part of the way that we met in the middle on that was she's been teaching me lessons in Unity. So like we've been doing some skill trading in addition to like the rate we worked out for Meat Punks.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
That's cool because it's investing in a community and like another creator who you think is good and worthwhile. Like it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And the idea that you can do that on a one-to-one level means there's no reason it shouldn't be possible at scale, right? Where it's super easy to just send to your five composers or whatever to a Unity seminar. Like the idea that these patterns, of course they start on the ground, but the idea that they don't repeat is just silly and a solvable problem.
Yeah. There's a lot of, upswelling right now in terms of just reevaluating the way that we do what we consider like normal work practices in the industry, especially in the game industry right now. And like Game Workers Unite is doing a lot of cool work to talk with people at all levels to like fix that conversation. But I feel like the people that like I'm coming up with right now in games are very much adamant about this being something that's important. And so I think if, yeah, we can last long enough and sustain ourselves and each other, hopefully we can see some of that have an impact at the corporate level.
Yeah. And game workers, correct me if I'm wrong, the way I understand Game Workers Unite's primary goal, they would like to see developers and people who work for developers unionize.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about unions, and it's tricky because the game industry is so international that national unions won't necessarily be the right path, but there's a lot of people having the conversations about what sort of organization and collective bargaining we can put together to make crunch disappear and to provide parental leave and to provide actual accessibility for folks with different needs. So there's like so many things across the board that need to be adjusted. I think that starts on the small level with new punks.
Yeah, no, totally. But I mean, doing it right and showing that it can be done right and that something worthwhile and, you know, the society cares successful, right, that sells copies can be done in an ethical and sustainable way. Like, that is such an important step, because I don't know that that's necessarily the case in what we broadly call the indie game space either. I think the goal has been for a lot of studios, not all certainly, but first of all, to be a studio, right? Like, that's kind of the goal. And then the goal is to create something you can sell on Steam for, you know, for $20, more or less. The goal is to more or less reproduce a tiny version of the traditional quote-unquote AAA. And again, the reason I keep circling around that term is it implies exactly the thing you were saying kind of sucks, which is that production values equal value, right? The idea that if it looks expensive, it must be worthwhile, which is a dumb assumption.
Shiny is good.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Shiny is always going to be attractive. There's no way around it. But
I mean, our magpie brains like really have a hard time breaking that association in a lot of ways.
Sure. Yeah, totally. I mean, and then I feel like the middle step is when you realize that's not quite the case, then it's easy to get like a little smug about, like, well, I see through the veil, right? Like, because there's a lot to learn from those giant games, and there's a lot to love in them. It's just that, like, man, the shininess, it is both asset and liability, I suppose. It doesn't allow for the most interesting experimental stuff most of the time.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, again, that's not a new problem by any stretch. What, Anna Entropy said that defined a AAA game as a game that's only interesting when it breaks. Or something,
right?
There's some truth to that, right? That like when the aesthetic is too polished, the systems are too polished, the narrative is too boilerplate, so you don't get to do anything, you don't get to express anything new. And in fact, there's an audience that explicitly doesn't want you to do anything new. They want to play the same game again, like, shinier.
This is totally off topic, but speaking of broken games, Skate 3.
I've not played it.
There's an incredible series of YouTube videos, but I think the person's name is Helix Snake.
Okay.
I got really deep into this rabbit hole in like 2016. This YouTuber basically like takes Skate 3 and just finds all the ways that they can break it.
That's amazing.
And so they end up like creating this like montage of like silent, beautiful, evocative art of their Skate 3 character just in these absurd situations, like having the body like wrap on itself.
Whoa.
They find ways to break gravity in the game, and so they go flying on like construction pallets. They like get stuck in the floor. There's this thing you can do in Skate 3 where if you're falling, you can like tuck into an egg and like tumble a little bit, and they like have mastered the way to turn that into just like a permanent like rolling forward like a Goron in Zelda.
So they end up tumbling through the void in the fetal position.
They're like tumbling through these like city landscapes.
Whoa.
And yeah, these videos are like 10 minutes long.
Yeah.
No, just the diegetic game audio. It's incredible.
That's incredible.
I highly recommend.
I will absolutely look that up and link it. Yeah. I mean, it's not 100% off topic, right? Because like, again, the glitch aesthetic is built into Meat Punks for sure. And also the idea of the world breaking is kind of in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's related to something we've been circling around, but not actually saying so far. Like, I mean, you've said it. But, like, the world sucks a little bit right now in terms of, like...
The world sucks a lot of it right now.
Yeah, the world sucks a lot of it right now. And it's, again, the other thing that's sort of refreshing about Meat Punks is that you're not punching, you know, the First Order. You're punching Fash, right? The way the game treats fascism as fascism is really important, I think. It doesn't have that kind of plausible deniability where it's like, well, what are we talking about, really?
Right.
I don't know. It's just, it's exciting to me.
What I like about like the Heather's portrayal of the Fash, which are just all the neo-Nazis in the game who are allied and basically also the cops,
Yeah, so you end up, you fight Afash in the parking lot, and it ends up being the sheriff's son, I believe. That's why our group has to leave town initially.
Right. Yeah. Is that they also talk in just terrible internet troll speak.
Right.
So I think, like, this sort of, like, bad faith language is also, I mean, super tied to fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very cathartic to see them get skewered in the ways they do in the game.
Yeah, definitely. Not just the fact that they lose, but the fact that they are made fun of for acting the way analogous people act in reality, right? Like, that's something you don't see very much.
Right.
And again, that's partly just cowardice, because AAA games are supposed to appeal to everyone, and that presumably or even explicitly includes hateful idiots.
Right.
That sucks. Yeah. Denying that possibility is, I think, powerful.
Yeah. I mean, I think I told you about this. So at Play NYC,
mm-hmm.
had a weird situation where within an hour of setting up MePunks and showing it off,
yeah,
we had some people play it, had some really good responses. I would watch people walk by and they just go, MePunks, to themselves as they read the sign, which I think is a good sign that the name works. But I saw this one guy standing off to the side, kind of just like with his arms crossed and just confused.
Hmm.
So I walked over. Did I tell you this?
No, I don't think so.
I walked over to him and I was like, hey, do you have any questions? This is Extreme MePunks Forever. It's a game about a bunch of nonsense, blah, blah, blah. And he was just like harumphing to himself. He's like, huh. And I was like, I feel that way too, you know, trying to engage.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was like, what's up? He's like, how much of this game is based on reality? And not expecting that question at all, I told him, like, with a wink and a smile, 100%, which he didn't want to hear.
Mm.
I don't know if he didn't want me to, like, be jokey with him or he thought I was serious. But then he sullenly said to me that, quote, this game overrepresents the Nazi threat, before walking off.
That's interesting. I saw something similar in the thread, like, on Hitch of the game.
Uh-huh.
Someone saying, like, I don't know where you live, where you're just seeing Nazis walk around, but I don't think that's reality.
It's centrists, you know?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. It's, there's a guy on YouTube, and I can't remember his name, and I will look it up. Peter Coffin is his name, who talks about, like, how horseshoe theory is nonsense, and it's actually a fishhook.
Because mm-hmm.
You have the far left over here,
mm-hmm.
and then you have the far right, but it actually curves back on itself, where centrists, by accommodating the far right, end up pretty close to them and ever mm-hmm. further. Because there is no, like, radical left in this country in power, in the U.S.
Right.
We have a center-right party, the Democrats, and then we have, you know, capitulation to encouraging fascism. Like, that's what we've got
mm-hmm.
to work with. So it's like, you ascribe that to centrism, that idea of, like, the idea that, like, it's not real or something. Like, I don't even know how to argue with it because it's so divorced from, like, what I see when I look at stuff, you know?
Right. Yeah. It was really goofy. And fortunately, he got laughed away by mm-hmm. the people I was with. So that was very satisfying.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's laughable. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But you know, the internet being the internet, I'm sure that guy has a large group of people who are going to affirm that, in fact, it's ridiculous to assume that there are Nazis. And part of it is just, like, you know, white privilege, cis privilege, whatever. You don't run into hateful idiots as often, and or because their hate is not directed at you, you're able to laugh it off as a charming quirk rather than a fundamental defect of character. Right?
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Rhetorically, you there, not you personally, right?
Yeah, no. I'm just thinking about how this has come up in other areas, but I don't know if I want to get into it.
That's right. And yeah, that's totally right. Yeah. No, I mean, I feel like it's important to actually talk about it, because I think, you know, like, there's a fungal aspect to those kind of ideologies where they thrive in dark places where you don't want to take them seriously as things worth debating, because they're not, and also debate with bad faith actors is just a commercial for the bad faith actors. But at the same time, if the only, this is another YouTube quote, I think, but, like, no one ever says, it's not my job to educate you about white nationalism if they're a white nationalist. They've always got time for that.
Right.
So if people who are still figuring out what they believe only hear that, then it starts to lend credence to the idea that, like, well, everyone thinks it. Some people are just too PC to say it or whatever nonsense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's uncomfortable and it sucks to talk about, and it feels like a hamster wheel to a certain degree, but I think it's important to get on the record sort of about how, yeah, like, there are people who are fascists just sort of walking around. I mean, we're in New York City, here for sure, and basically everywhere in the country, you know, increasingly everywhere in the world. It's a perennially appealing idea to people, even though it has no value.
Right. Yeah. I think my it's hard, like, just living in this like soup of terribleness all the time, and like because of that, I think it's like in some ways as radical as it is to like punch a real life Nazi, I think it's also really radical to surround yourself with queer folks or folks of your different identity vectors that like understand you and support you and just find like good things and just sit in that as much as possible.
Yeah.
Like draw strength from each other. So I feel like, yeah, it's like two sides of the same coin. Like you have like the sort of negative work of like negating these things that are out there, but then also the positive work of like building community in an important way.
Yeah.
And I feel like my year in the last year has been much more of the second.
Yeah, for sure.
Which has been really healthy, I think.
That's really good. Yeah, and it also, again, you were talking about burnout in the context of work, but it happens too in the context of just being a person in the world, right? Like you can't fight the good fight every hour of every day, or you'll go nuts, you know, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, something like I think I've struggled a lot with this year is balancing my duties as a citizen with like real shit that like I'm facing, and trying to not feel guilty for trying to take care of myself and my friends.
For sure.
Before I can call my senator every day.
Yeah. Yeah. One, it's also uniquely helpful when, like, you know, my representative is good. You know what I mean? Like, it's, that is weirdly disempowering in a certain way, that just like, I don't know, I have a flexible enough work schedule that I could be calling my senator every day, right? But it's not just that I feel burned out about it, it's that that won't help. So it's like, well, I think a lot of people feel like, well, what will?
You know? I mean, I also like brush up against a little bit that it won't help because like, you live in New York?
Yeah.
Yeah, like Chuck Schumer is kind of a...
Oh, Chuck Schumer sucks.
Sucks.
Yeah. I specifically meant Jerry Nadler, 10th District.
Oh, okay.
That dude, the
small,
who,
yeah.
Exactly. The guy who's going to respond most to what I have to say. Yvette, yeah, I agree that Schumer sucks. Yvette, I wish you were up this time.
Yvette Clark in the 9th is a total boss. She's so great.
Yeah, she's great. She's really good.
She's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. No, agreed about Schumer, though. I mean, not up this time, so there's nothing we can do about it at the moment.
Yeah, but I have left him some angry voicemails.
I have to. Yeah. Because like 538 has the Trump score, right? How often do they vote with Trump? And his is not excellent as far as, capitulating.
Yeah. Also, he, like, saluted the, like, bombings in Yemen.
Totally.
And
Yeah. Okay, can I change gears completely?
Yes,
because I don't want to, again, I don't want to burn out. I want to talk about something totally different you made that I like a lot.
Okay.
You made this series of records called Songs for Unmade Worlds that were, like, soundtracks to games that don't yet exist.
Mm-hmm.
They're great. I really just want to point people at them.
Oh, thanks.
Can you talk a little bit about like what the impetus was to do that?
So the year was 2015.
Tell me more.
I was in a weird place where I was figuring out what I wanted to do musically, mm-hmm. and also I was working through hella gender shit. And so when I first like left my undergrad program in 2012. I graduated. I don't know why I said left so mysteriously.
Completed, finished. Yeah, yeah. Moved on.
I walked away.
Yeah.
I
just walked out.
Gasoline the place and lit a match and threw it behind me.
Light the Way by Burning a Bridge.
I thought I wanted to do like indie music stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like focused on that for a couple years and like toured in 2014 as like a solo indie electronic musician under Visager, the name that I still use.
That was when that Heap record came out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that came out. I did that in like 2013.
Which again is very good, and again totally different from the other stuff you make.
Like, thanks. Yeah. It feels like such a long time ago. I made a music video.
I have not seen that.
Wrapped in the music video. It's private.
Okay, well, understood. Then I will not check that.
Yeah. Just like, I don't necessarily want me rapping with a beard on the internet as much anymore.
Fair.
Yeah. and I was doing some composition work on at the time. I was working with this guy, Brandon Powers, doing some, like, theater stuff. And, like, some plays with Ariel Zatina, who is now an awesome DJ. Like, we've each all gone in kind of, like, different directions. But, like, wasn't, like, feeling it. Or, I don't know. I was kind of, like, lost. And I think a lot of that also is tied to just working through gender stuff. I think when you get to the... And not to generalize everyone's experience, but in my experience and some of my friends' experiences, when you're like in this, like coming out of this like long egg incubation period,
mm-hmm.
It just like takes up so much mental energy and creative energy and psychic energy that you just kind of like close down. I was also playing Hearthstone a lot, and that didn't help anything.
As far as insularity, or is there just as far as like...
Just like total, just didn't have time to do anything because I was playing Hearthstone for like 2 hours a day.
It was just truly eating whatever time you would spend on figuring
stuff. Or it was just, you know, kind of basic escapism.
Totally. Got it.
I guess I came to the conclusion that A, I didn't like playing live shows. Mm-hmm. I didn't like having to translate electronic music into a live setting. I thought it was kind of lame and fakey having to use a lot of pre-recorded music because I was performing solo most of the time. Or even if I like brought in some friends to play like drums and bass, it was like a lot of work and money to like hire people and also pay for a space to practice and all that.
Totally.
So I just wasn't really vibing with it. And at the same time, I was like trying to figure out how I could work more in games. And so I figured, although I had made a lot of music, I didn't have stuff that sounded very video gamey or like was like really focused or just targeted in that way that could like show, I could like show to developers like, hey, I want to make video game music. Here's some video game music, style music, whatever that means, that I've made. And so I started working on these songs from an Unmade World album, thinking about like a Zelda style game using primarily like the YMCK 8 Magical 8-Bit plugin, which is like a free plugin. It has four tracks. It's like old NES style, you know, two...
US channel, square wave, triangle wave kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And it's really flexible. It has like a specific sound that's like not totally accurate, but I'm not a purist in any sense of the word.
Sure.
So I uploaded those in like a bunch of places. And it's kind of weird because it's like I sort of did like... spec work in a way, but it was also like my art and like,
sure,
I can do whatever I want with my art. I wasn't like doing spec work for anyone. So,
well, they do stand alone and they are kind of program music. Like they're not just like, they actually, especially the Forest World one, which the first two sound a bit like Zelda, like you said, but the Forest World one really does sound like a game that doesn't exist yet. Maybe even in a genre that doesn't quite exist yet with with the field recording stuff, you know, mixed with the textures. And it's like, there's just a lot of different genres smashed together, and like I love it a lot, but it stands alone and you can imagine it being soundtrack work. So I totally see how it's both. It's a portfolio and it's a standalone piece.
Yeah. That's, thanks.
Yeah.
I ended up uploading those sequentially on Free Music Archive. And although they didn't get like a lot of hits, I think just after a while, like people just look for chiptune music all the time for like YouTube, like intros, and like for Twitch streams and for podcasts. Mm-hmm. And eventually, like, that's how the Blossom Tail guys found me. It was just through these uploads on Free Music Archive. And so it's like just total serendipity, and kind of weird to still think about, especially because like, Blossom Tails ended up on the Switch, and like two of the tracks in Blossom Tails were just kind of like lifted from these albums. It was like my music. I could reuse it however I wanted.
Sure.
And so now those songs are on a Nintendo console, which is weird.
It's pretty neat. Yeah, I mean, like it's funny, like for all the things we're talking about how like the main modes of production are busted and whatever, they still have cachet and they still have like, not just, you know, in terms of the economy, but in terms of emotion. Like there's something about being on a Nintendo console. I've talked to a bunch of people about this, that just like, it's special, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's a legacy to it.
Yeah. And we were like early too, so it was like extra exciting. FTG had like a dev kit from like way before anyone else, for who knows why. It came out like the same year that the Switch came out, which was like...
And it was one of those like early indie successes where a lot of people who might not have tried it because
there wasn't as much on that time. Yeah. I've heard people call it like a little bit like a Vita Lite now with all like the...
Sure.
There's so much now.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I think it's good.
Definitely good, yeah. It's, I mean, Nintendo doesn't make it super easy to find the good stuff, especially because you can't buy stuff through a browser, so no one can link directly. Well, you can buy stuff, but you can't like... If there's a demo, you can't download it. You can't wishlist it. You can't do some of the stuff that people expect.
Totally. Yeah.
But yeah, so much good stuff is out on there. And stuff that people missed the first time around, stuff that is just new and interesting. It's neat. It's become a good place for that stuff.
Yeah, totally.
But I would say Itch is still the place to be if you want to find something genuinely weird, like that you haven't seen before.
I think like Itch, I call Itch like the Bandcamp of games.
Yeah, for sure.
If like... Steam is iTunes,
right,
and therefore kind of evil, like, Itch is Bandcamp.
DRM, Central Control, all that stuff.
Like, Itch is, like, genuinely supportive of, like, queer art, And
that's where Robert Yang uploads his stuff, right? Mm-hmm, which can't stay on Steam at all.
Right. Yeah. You can like flex the percentages that you make as a dev off the games. And so it's like really ethical in a lot of ways.
Bandcamp is not like that, right? It's a high percentage, but it's a set percentage. Is that
right? So the Bandcamp pricing model is basically they take 15% unless you've made $5,000 in a year,
mm-hmm.
in which case your percentage goes down to 10% that they take off of you.
That's cool.
Yeah. So if someone wants to buy a lot of my albums this year, they could help me make more money in the future.
That's fair. That's fair. I mean, they're up there and they're really good. So
thanks.
I'll obviously link to your Bandcamp. cool. So Spice of Life, that was the other game soundtrack of yours that I was really, I mean, there's like, what, four tracks, three tracks, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
But they're great. Was that similar where like someone heard your quasi-spec work?
Yeah, actually, so Mary Georgescu was the person who hired me for that, and mm-hmm. she was finishing up, it was her thesis project at the School of Visual Arts here in New York. So it was my first time getting to work on a game where I could like meet up with the person
totally.
And talk to them at a cafe, which was like really refreshing. And Mary continues to be a good friend. She wrote me like a letter of recommendation for a thing. And also I just did music for this podcast that she's starting called Children of the Storm. So yeah, we're still closely in touch.
Really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't look like the game is currently available like to download and play anywhere that I could find. I saw videos of it.
Actually, so yeah, it's an arcade.
Okay.
And she is showing it at different games this year.
Cool.
So if anyone's going to that, they can play this little weird, kooky robot chef arcade.
Robot learning to cook. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet. That's awesome.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. That's fantastic. I think those were my main questions.
Okay.
Anything else you want to talk about? Anything you want to get out there?
If folks are listening to this who liked the style of the Meat Punks music, I was also working on another punk tune right now.
Yeah.
For this game called Gay Monster Kiss Club.
It's a great title.
Yeah. Ryan Rose or at Gender Vamp is the main dev, and like they're so great and hired me like a month ago. Like they're working with a different composer, but like their composer doesn't do punk.
Mm-hmm.
And so they reached out to me. They were a frequent collaborator with Heather also.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like this like nice, it's nice to like stay in the circle a little bit. I'll be up at the Queerness and Games Con next weekend.
Cool.
And we'll be showing that off there. That was super fun. I'm actually singing on the track.
Yeah, that's awesome.
In character. There's like a house show in the game. And so like, this is like a live punk song that's happening that you can go watch in the game.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. And then I'm also working on this game called My Electric Heart, which is like another gay robot visual novel game.
Cool.
But haven't actually started production on that yet, but I'm extremely stoked about it.
Yeah. Can you say anything else about what it's going to be? Like,
yeah.
Gay robot visual novel, I'm already sold and want to play it, but, you know.
I don't know what I'm allowed to say.
That's fair.
But if you go check out at MEH Game,
okay.
For My Electric Heart, Meh Game, on Twitter, they have like a lot of art up and some like hints about what's going on in the game, and I'm really stoked about it.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one other thing, actually.
Yeah.
So I know you're in grad school right now, mm-hmm. and that tends to eat one's time and life and attention.
Yeah.
But is there other stuff that you've been kind of liking lately, you know, music you've been discovering or books, games, whatever?
Through grad school or just like in general?
In general. I mean, either or.
Yeah. I've been listening to this album by this Japanese band called Sayu by Sayu, like Sayux mm-hmm. Sayu. They've done some work with Cornelius, if you listen to his stuff. I think they did a song for one of the Ghost in the Shell OVAs. But their work is super cool. It's like loopy, experimental, like funk-inspired electronic minimalist music.
Cool.
It's really good.
I'll check that out.
So
for sure.
I would heavily recommend it. I've been listening to it a lot this week.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Maybe we shouldn't push our luck with the rumor in.
Okay.
We got good stuff.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for doing this.
This was really fun, Drew. It was really nice talking.
Absolutely. So you can get Extreme Meat Punks Forever on Itch. Five out of the six episodes of season one are out currently.
Mm-hmm.
Season two will probably happen at some point in the future, but who knows? It's really good, and everybody should 100% play it. So, Josie, thanks again.
Thanks, Drew. This was super fun.
Yeah.
Take care.
You too.
And that's the show. You can find all of Josie's music at visager.bandcamp.com. That's visager.bandcamp.com. You can find Extreme Meat Punks Forever at hthr.itch.io/extreme-meatpunks-forever. And you can find this podcast basically everywhere podcasts are a thing. And in fact, if you listen to podcasts somewhere that you cannot find this one, let me know, at me, at Drew M. Michaels on Twitter, and I will do my best to rectify that situation. Offer does not apply to Spotify. Who knows what they did? You can also find this podcast at participating blood stations or at etao.blog.